Here is Tony Gosling, hot foot from the No to War, No to NATO meeting yesterday in London. Welcome to the programme, Tony.
Hi there, Basil. Yeah, I did have a bit of sleep in the meantime, so not quite directly from there, but I needed it too because quite a lot of trekking around London. I mean, it was a fantastic day yesterday. I really enjoyed it. Just meeting some of the other people who are, I mean, one of the things that I said in my talk, which went down quite well, was where is Stop the War? The Stop the War Coalition, because at this point in the war with Iraq, which I mean, it's arguable that the Brits are just as much involved in Ukraine as they were in Iraq. There were mass demonstrations of millions of people coming out on the streets of London. There were demonstrations all around the country, very well organised against, for example, the US bases which were being used. Now what we have is we have a website which I looked at the other day, the Stop the War Coalition, saying that the Russians need to withdraw from Crimea, and they call Crimea Ukraine. So effectively, this group run by Lindsay German, John Rees, and these other people, by the way, from one of these factional communist parties, an ex-Socialist Workers Party people, which was massively infiltrated, as anyone that reads the books about with this literature about by MI5, they're stopping the war. So they're not going to stop this Ukraine war at all. Anyway, there's a massive dilemma at the heart of the Ukraine war, which only a few people seem to have picked up on. And that is that the Russians are in a terrible dilemma, because as soon as there's a peace agreement and everything sort of falls silent and they've got some agreed borders, that is a green light for Ukraine to then join NATO. Because NATO can't accept a Ukrainian whilst there's an ongoing conflict and border dispute. So, There's loads of, you know, complexities to everything that's going on, which are just simply not even addressed by Lindsay German, John Rees, and the rest of them, Andrew Murray, at the Stop the War Coalition. So they're not going to stop the war. So we were the, you know, I suppose the vanguard, really, stood opposite 10 Downing Street in this amazing, I mean, people, if anyone's in London, please do go and visit people there in what they call, what the establishment is calling the Pen. But actually, it's a brilliant little spot where several people are camped out, rather like Brian Hoare was 15, 20 years ago.
Oh, right. So there is a permanent presence in Whitehall, is there?
Absolutely, yeah. So any of your listeners are in London, please do just go and visit them. Maybe a little donation of some bottled water or, you know, whatever you fancy. They're an absolutely brilliant crew. And they're in a very difficult spot there. For anyone that knows anything about these protest sites, you know, you get street drinkers turning up, drug addicts, drug dealers turning up wanting to move in. You know, even if they're only camping, they're able to deal the drugs and things. So they have a very good, I think, way of dealing with that, which is that they will let people sleep overnight in a slightly separate place. But anyway, it's an absolutely brilliant spot and a great place to be doing this little protest. As at the same time as we were doing our protest, around about halfway through, half past two, up turns the Ukrainians and these Ukrainian flags. And one of them, which has got the Wolfsangel on it, right? So a friend of mine is actually down from Bristol for the day. He went over to them and confronted them. This is a Nazi symbol. We don't want this in Whitehall. Thank you very much. And, of course, that caused a bit of a kerfuffle with the pro-Ukraine demonstrators just down the road. And the police were pretty good. They realised that there was a potentiality of conflict between the No to NATO and the Ukraine protest next to us. But there wasn't, ultimately. You know, and this sort of fizzled out, this discussion about having a Nazi symbol in Whitehall. But anyhow, it was a brilliant day, all in all.
Well, it's in proximity to the cenotaph, of course, the admittedly rather sinister-looking war memorial right there in the middle of Whitehall, in the middle of the street, that is the focus of the annual service of remembrance. So, you know, definitely not really the right place for any Nazi symbolism, particularly when so many, of course, gave their lives fighting Nazism.
Well, you know what, Basil, 1930. In a way, it is an appropriate place, because what's happened since World War II is the tables have totally turned round. And for many of these wars that we've had, particularly since 9/11, you know, the Afghanistan invasion, the Syria attacks, the Iraq invasion, the Libya attack, we are now the bullies of the world in military terms. You know, the Brits and the Americans, the Anglo-Zionist Empire has become, you know, what was Hitler of the 1930s, you know, invading, bombing, depend, you know, wherever they choose, and completely tearing up the international rule of law. And so in a way, it's quite appropriate that we're seeing this right outside the cenotaph. And I think, you know, for many people, it is a very serene and a kind of sacred thing, this, the war memorials. And when they go there, they're thinking, well, you know, my relatives died for world freedom. And as Churchill called at the time, the future of Christian civilization. And what's happened, of course, is we are now the problem. We've become the problem. And a lot of that I was talking about in my speech, which was the fact that NATO kind of embodies this incorporation of much of the Nazi ideology, Nazi personnel, Nazi tactics, specific Nazi tactics into the Western alliance. And NATO has been the, you know, the plague bacillus, you know, which has infected us with the same thing that was, or a very similar thing that was the problem in the 1930s with the Nazis.
Yes, of course. And of course, actual Nazi personnel immediately after the war became very senior officials in NATO, did they not?
Yeah, they did. And I read out a list of 9 or 10 specific Nazis who were middle, high-ranking officers in the army that we were fighting in World War II that got the top jobs in NATO. Now, I mean, we're talking about, you know, chairman of the military committee and the other kind of military posts. Now, of course, the Soviet Union, looking at all of this, would have seen exactly what was going on. In fact, as I was recounting to a friend of mine, Winston Churchill had to be kept off the airwaves or any live microphones after World War II, you know, after he was booted out as Prime Minister, because every time he got near a live microphone at the BBC Home Service, he was talking about, he only got away with it once, but he wanted to nuke Moscow. And, you know, seeing communism as a continuing threat, blah, blah, which is one of the reasons, of course, that Edward VIII and other senior Brits, like the chairman of the Bank of England, Montagu Norman, were funding the Nazis before the wars because they were afraid of this whole ideology that was growing under the Bolsheviks of, you know, egalitarianism and taking the wealth from the rich and giving it to the poor. And so, you know, NATO's been a big part of that. And so I started off my talk really looking at 1948 and the creation of the State of Israel and 1949 and
the creation of NATO. Yes, yeah. Of course. I'm just looking at the Stop the War Coalition website and an article published a few days ago by Katrina Van Hoyvel and James Carden, not Corden. And the headline is, as the Ukraine counteroffensive turns into a brutal slog, is it time for talking? Well, I would have thought that any organization calling itself Stop the War, the time for talking was automatically now. Yet this headline appears to be equivocating.
Well, I know, and I actually had a good old look through the website last week, and there is still, I think it's in the events section, old thing there about the Russians must withdraw, you know. So this is where they're coming from. I made the point effectively that when the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, there was a whole load of dealing going on around the world about how to get all the votes at the newly founded UN in order to get a vote to allow the creation of the State of Israel. And there were a lot of people opposed to it. Victor Rothschild, who was a Labour peer, quite young in those days, he'd been involved in MI5, etc., and getting a lot of British secrets. If you're ever interested in him, I mean, there's a fantastic book called The Fifth Man by Roland Perry, who's an Australian journalist who worked in Fleet Street for a long time. He's retired now, but he's still doing some stuff in Sydney University. And Roland's book, The Fifth Man, is really, I mean, it's an amazing trajectory. He had a Jewish publisher, so he went to his publisher and said, I've got all this stuff on Victor. You know, he didn't even need to say what his surname was in the London publishing community. And he came up with these little bits and pieces of evidence, and the publisher said, let's go for it. And they published that book. And it was just after Victor had died in the mid-1990s. And so, you know, this was... Victor delivered a lot of the votes because of all the work he'd done for the Soviet Union for that vote at the UN. But over the other side of the Atlantic, there are a lot of people also who were very sceptical about Israel. And Nelson Rockefeller managed to get through the, you know, US grace and favor in South America quite a lot of the votes for the State of Israel. But he went to Ben Gurion, the first boss of Israel, as he was to become, and he was the main person to negotiate with at the time. You know, he had been really representing the Jewish terrorist groups, and he yeah. said, "You can have a country or vengeance, but not both." And that was the deal. So he could deliver all these votes that would get them the foundation of their state at the UN, but they would have to give up any idea of going chasing after Nazi war criminals. The Israelis would. Now, of course, they did that with Eichmann in the 1960s, but really only once. And so that was the deal. And that's how the state of Israel came into being, really. It was always a part of making sure that the main victims of the Nazis, not just the obviously Europeans, but the whole Jewish community in this newly formed state of Israel, had absolutely knew that they were only there because of this deal to make sure they didn't go after the war criminals. And this was obviously very, very good for the Nazis. And that's when, after a few years, we got the creation of Bilderberg in 1954. And this was the sort of formal NATO lobby. You know, so NATO had been going for 7 or 8 years or so. And then they realized that we want to make sure that this new organization, which was mainly Britain, the US, and France, and that they got their way when it came to politicians. And that was always the point of Bilderberg as a lobby to make sure that these guys, and he was chaired for the first 20 years by a former SS officer. You know, now anyone really looking at this, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, anyone looking at this will know this is a political lobby for NATO within the NATO countries. And it's chaired by an ex-SS officer, one of the first people ever actually to join the Nazi party when he was a young man in Germany. And he then married into the Dutch royal family just before the war broke out. But he was an ex-SS guy. And he got discredited in the 70s. But then just running through a brief history. So we got 1966, we had the French kicking NATO out.
Just while we're on Prince Bernhard, he was a close friend of the late Duke of Edinburgh, wasn't he?
He was very friendly, yeah. I mean, I think they knew people that had been to the same schools and that sort of thing. I mean, Phil the Greek... I'm not quite sure how much of a really pro-Nazi. I mean, he was brought up in that world of elitism. Of course, that whole royal family, I wouldn't say the Queen was, but I think there were a lot of people involved in the royal family who did see this whole idea of keeping wealth and stopping communism and stopping socialism, that sort of thing, as being very important. But, yes, Bernhard.
Well, Edward VIII, above all. I mean, of course, it was Edward VIII and Mrs. Simpson who went to Berlin and met Hitler and apparently had a German invasion of Britain in 1939, 1940 been successful. Hitler was planning on installing Edward VIII as king.
Yeah, Blenheim Palace. Blenheim, that's where they wanted to use as the sort of, you know, forget London. And I suppose they were maybe thinking that it would have been bombed to bits by the time the Germans had installed themselves here.
Blenheim is particularly splendid, I must admit, you know.
Yeah, and it's got some sort of weird, I was seeing the other day, it's got these kind of Illuminati eyes. It's part of the, if you stand underneath the main atrium, you look up and there's these Illuminati triangle eyes looking down at you. But anyway, of course, we no talk of the Illuminati around here. That's all just a complete and utter fantasy and never really happened at all.
Of course. Tony, we're going to cross your fingers, please. We're going to take a quick break. Wonderful insight, as always, here from Tony Gosling. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, more on the Not Stopping the War coalition, the peace talks in Saudi Arabia. Are they going anywhere?
Patrick Henningsen talks on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
This is Basil Valentine in for Patrick Henningsen today, Monday the 7th of August 2023. And I'm delighted to say I'm joined on the line by Tony Gosling. Welcome back to the programme, Tony.
Hi there, Basil. Yeah, we had a pretty good lineup. So Patrick Henningsen was there, Richard Medhurst, who was extremely good. But I mean, really, in a way, the best was Chris Williamson, having been an ex-MP under Corbyn. And, you know, he's one of those that Jeremy Corbyn treated worse than he did his enemies. You know, he was treating people like Margaret Hoyt better than his friends, you know. So he was great. He was actually really, really good, Chris. And he's just, because it all just flows with him. Absolutely no notes, nothing at all. But it all it's all got it all. And there was Niall McRae, he was really good. He was analysing this whole thing of really the left and right are becoming very similar and the same. And actually, the middle ground are becoming the extremists. You know, this is what sort of Tony Blair's third way. These are the maniacs. So they're being portrayed by the press.
Yes, they are the warmongers.
Yeah, they've been portrayed by the press as the moderates and the centrists, you know. But actually, they want more. Like I say, more. Peter Ford was there as well. Very good. He's the ex-British ambassador to Syria. So it was a pretty cool lineup, actually. And the weather was beautiful. It was a tight, about three or four spots of rain, and that was it. And lots of sun in Whitehall. So, you know, yeah, we had a lovely time. And we left it, I think, on my little timeline I'm going to try and do quickly here, was at the French kicking NATO out back in 1966, which a lot of people forget about. And they actually NATO stayed out, that's the Americans mainly, obviously, out of France for nearly 50 years. They only came back in under Sarkozy in 2013.
That's right.
And this was a very much like this. If you look at what was been happening in Niger last week, you know, the French, as soon as the coup happens, the French will have to pile onto several transport planes and out they go. You know, all the French forces there, because otherwise they'll be surrounded and killed. And so this is really what de Gaulle was saying to the Americans, like, get out of France now, because we don't want a confrontation between our armed forces and yours. And so the Americans did exactly that. They got on the planes and left. And, you know, of course, we this week are in the rather frightening situation of having American drones now being applied to the Civil Aviation Authority to fly those drones out of Fairford in Gloucestershire, just north of me in Bristol. And that means that those drones are really going to have the range of all over Europe. Now, they say that the drones are going to be flying to Eastern Europe. And it really, what it means is that they can fly anywhere they want. And every time you hear of a gas explosion in a house in the middle of the night, anywhere in Europe, including Ireland, et cetera, it could be a political dissident of some sort that's being killed by an American Hellfire missile. But, I mean, they're talking about surveillance, of course, but these drones can carry anything. And once the Americans get permission from the CIA to fly drones out of Fairford, we're going to be seeing exactly the same sort of thing going on around Europe as we have in places like Libya. And in fact, I don't know, somebody pointed out to me the other day that we've just had the first admission of a drone strike in Libya. Which has been done completely by AI. So in other words, the targeting has been selected by AI. The thing has been flown and guided by AI, and the missiles have been released by AI. And this is where we're going with the drones, of course, because you get human operators. They tend to go, well, hang on, I'm not killing these kids, you know. But the AI doesn't seem to bother too much about that. So that's why I think this whole idea of the French kicking NATO out, you know, back in 1966. Mm-hmm. De Gaulle. You remember the Day of the Jackal? I'm sure most of your listeners have seen the Day of the Jackal film. If the younger people haven't, please do go and seek it out. It's a terrific
It contains one of my favourite lines in all cinema, where Michel Lonsdale, very fine actor who plays the police commissioner, is reporting to the French equivalent of the security cabinet every day. And on one day he goes in there and is forced to admit, "The jackal has completely disappeared, but we believe he may be masquerading as a Danish schoolteacher."
God. Well, that's right.
After he steals a passport from a Dane at an airport and then dyes his hair and everything to make him.
Anyway, it's a terrific film, isn't it? It is a fantastic film, and it really was about the American attempt to... at least the CIA's wish to get a hitman to bump off de Gaulle for getting NATO out of France. So, you know, I think everyone needs to understand exactly what was going on in the
Of course, in the film, it's made out that it's the French patriots opposed to the French withdrawal from Algeria that are backing the hitman. Yeah.
That's right. But there's much more geopolitics going on behind the scenes. And, and also, of course, the Americans were really, really annoyed with the French, you know. So anyway, that was in the 60s. And in the 70s, we had Prince Bernhard outed, this ex-SS officer that had been the chairman of Bilderberg, the NATO political lobby, for completely secret, of course. You know, they meet in secret. Most years they
They got no press coverage at all. Occasionally, there would be one or two journalists that discover them. They had all sorts of cover stories where they lied to say things like it's a croquet competition and nothing to do with the world's politicians all secretly getting together with the military.
That's right.
And so Bernhard was outed in the Lockheed scandal. He'd taken a bribe of $1 million from Lockheed when he was in the Dutch royal family to get the Dutch Air Force to buy these Lockheed Starfighters, which, by the way, were terrible aircraft. They just fell out of the sky. They got tiny wings, really bad planes. But that's not the point. The point is he was rumbled, and so he had to leave as the chairman of Bilderberg after that big scandal in 75. In the 1980s, you've got Operation Gladio. You know, this is in Italy. 3,000 people in Italy were killed, mainly in Italy it was. It was in Belgium and other countries too, but almost all in Italy. And the problem was, of course, the Italians were starting to become a bit communist. They wanted communists running the country, and they wanted socialists running the country. Aldo Moro is the prime minister, was kidnapped by NATO, by NATO intelligence, and P2, the Licio Gelli and the propaganda Due Lodge in Italy. And it was all money from the CIA, from the State Department. And around about 3,000. So this is things like the Piazza Fontana bombing of a bank. There was the Bologna railway station.
The railway station. Lots of people died in that, didn't they? That was an absolute outrage.
That's right. And so this is NATO blowing up European citizens and then saying, "Oh, we think it was a communist that did this, and so you must need to be afraid of communists." No, it was fascists actually that were doing it. That were employed by NATO to do it. And if anyone hasn't seen the Alan Frankovich BBC program from 1992, the three-parter, all about that. Well, Frankovich died in rather mysterious circumstances not long after that was made. But, I mean, that just shows you the extent to which NATO will go to just, I mean, basically it's a terrorist organization domestically. Never mind our enemies, it's blowing up us. If it seems like it's convenient to them. Like I say, 3,000 or so people killed in Italy by NATO. So there's Operation Gladio in the 80s. This is a bit, you know, the latest in the NATO timeline of horror and death. 1989, which is the fall of the Berlin Wall, we had the US Secretary of State, James Baker, making a very grave pronouncement that we will not go one inch eastward.
That's right.
And then you started to expand eastward straight away, didn't you? You've now doubled the size of NATO with all these little Eastern European countries, well, some of them quite big. And so you lied and lied and lied with that one. So then we had the wonderful Yeltsin years, and Putin arrived in 2000. And there was a whole debacle with him, with the oligarchs, because these oligarchs that have been trained up in Switzerland and were sent in to rape in the 1990s under Yeltsin, rape Russia, really, just sell it all off, break it all up for private equity, what we would now call private equity, that is hedge funds and foreign investors who just buy this stuff up. But for peanuts, all the Russian industries sold off. And Putin arrived in 2000, and something very interesting happened when he turned up as president. But Boris Berezovsky, who was the chief oligarch he'd known for a long time, he'd been skiing with him when he was a young man. In Switzerland. And Putin, first things he did when he got into office was to speak to the chief prosecutor in Moscow and the Kremlin and said, "Well, look, what have you got on Berezovsky?" And it turned out there were some really damning indictments, which Yeltsin had pushed back and made sure never came to court, about the Aeroflot flotation, which is their national airline that got sold off by Berezovsky and, you know, loads of money made, etc. And he said, after a couple of months, he phoned Berezovsky up and he said, "Look, they're going to come to arrest you, on Monday." I think this was on a Saturday or something. And he said, I've been trying to stop this going through, but I can't so far. But if you give me a couple of weeks, I can. I'll stop the prosecution and whatever, but I'm just advising you as a friend. Good idea to get out of the country tonight, you know. And so Boris Berezovsky, the chief oligarch in raping Russia, hops on the first plane out to London, I believe. And that was it, because he never came back, and Putin had no intention of letting him back. But he knew by taking Berezovsky out and getting him out of Russia, this sent a message to all the other oligarchs. Look, I've taken out the chief oligarch, and if you start messing with the Kremlin, you'll be next. And so that was really the moment where the Kremlin started running the country again, rather than international capitalism in 2000, when Putin kicked out Berezovsky. And this was a very important, you know, time, because, you know, there were attempts, you know, to get, I mean, for example, Putin was joined the World Economic Forum. He also joined the G8, so he was making friends. He was saying, look, we do need to run this country, but we will be friends with the West. We'll go along with your various plans. And so, and in the meantime, behind his back, he was building up a very, very strong military. And that is over the next 20 years, in order to fight the Americans and beat them. And that's where we are now. So, you know, that's what, you know, one of the reasons I think that Putin was doing all this shenanigans in these big international organizations like G8, etc. It wasn't because he believed in it all. It's because he was buying time in order to keep his country independent from the rest of the world. Then we had, of course, Ukraine, 2014, CIA coup, and where we are in 2023 now with this ridiculous chant of "We will win, we will win." We heard on Sunday, yesterday, from the Ukrainian campaigners in Whitehall. I mean, we will win. I was listening to it thinking this is so empty, because you obviously will not win. You cannot win. There's no way you're going to win. But you're just sitting there chanting "we will win" in this empty fashion with your Wolfsangel Nazi sign above you. You know, so that was in a nutshell was my little run through the history of NATO and looking at, I suppose, some of the, you know, the way in which the whole ethos of Britain, just looking at us as probably the, you know, it's fair to say the United States as well, has changed from being the good guys to the bad guys, Basil.
Yeah, absolutely. And when do you think it was that the particularly sort of aggressive animosity towards Russia from the United Kingdom first began, when Putin took over? Because Patrick and I remember tracing it back to, we kicked a diplomat out after the Russia got the World Cup and things like that. There seems to be something in the British establishment that has a particular dislike for Russia and has done so for at least 20 years, if not longer. Some people would say 150 years. But they've certainly turned the dial up in the last 20 years, and I can't work out when exactly that was supposed to have started.
Well, it's been gradual, bit by bit, and you're right, it goes back centuries. You know, you can go really, I think, probably, I mean, obviously Hitler, because the British were funding Hitler as a bulwark against the Soviet Union in the 1930s. And so definitely at that point. But you can go back to Napoleon, for goodness sake. There was a big European establishment that was hoping very much that Napoleon was going to go in and sack Moscow. I'm sure most of your listeners know that Napoleon's army did get to Moscow, but Moscow had been evacuated and there was no food and no water, nothing there. And so this army turned up in Moscow. I mean, it's an amazing story, isn't it? So they turn up in Moscow and the whole place is no firewood, nothing. And so, yeah, you've taken over Moscow. Well done. Now what are you going to do? And they started to freeze. And the retreat from Moscow was one of the most horrific, hellish things that's ever happened in Europe. So the troops were dying on the way back. They had no food. They had, you know, just nothing at all. And
they were constantly raided by the Cossacks as well, weren't they? In retreat, there was sort of, endless ambushes and raids on them, weren't there? And it was the beginning of the end for Napoleon.
Well, that's it was. That was it. It was almost like a kind of Stalingrad sort of situation, a bit like Damascus was in the recent Syria battles. And, the American-Israeli attempt to balkanize and take over the Middle East, very sort of similar. But yeah, so I think actually it was the moment that the Russians were unceremoniously kicked out of the G8, and I'm not sure what that was, but that was the point at which I think the West really lost patience with Putin. But it was too late because he'd already built up a very, very powerful, they've got masses of natural resources, so they don't care about sanctions. They can build all their own stuff. They've got loads and loads of high-tech industries. Now, they don't care about sanctions at all, so this means nothing to them. And that's, I think, one of the main things that the West realised, that we simply cannot take these people on, particularly economically. You know, with the SWIFT system, they designed it so that IMF and these electronic
banking systems were that countries, all countries, are going to be completely dependent on them. But the Russians have built up alternative versions, as they're now, you know, very successful with the whole BRICS system, about to launch their own gold-backed currency. You know, they're way ahead of the game, and they've seen this coming for a long time. So I wound up my speech, Basil, with just looking at just how hopeless. And I was pointing across to Downing Street, saying they're a bunch of losers, and of course they are. Making the point, of course, that the guy in charge in Downing Street, Rishi Sunak, is really just a Goldman Sachs representative. You know, he's not, and that is bit means Bilderberg. Goldman Sachs have been at the main bank, main international finance people at Bilderberg for the last 20 years or so, and they just represent the Bilderberg. They represent international finance. They don't represent us, and Rishi Sunak doesn't represent us at all. And so what I was saying was that the strategy with Russia is a total disaster, and they are going to lose. They're losing in Ukraine. They lost just as they lost in almost all the other wars they've ever been involved in. Lost in Afghanistan, of course. These lose scenarios where they go in knowing they're going to lose. They just hope they're going to get some money in rebuilding these countries. And they're trying to fight not only internationally, the Chinese and the Russians, and losing those economic and military conflicts, but they're also losing, I think, as well, the battle against their own domestic populations. So they're just a bunch of losers. And whatever happens in the future, it's not going to be pretty. And maybe we won't be here to see the end of it. But at the end of the day, they are on a hiding to nothing with all these ridiculous, egocentric, maniacal policies that they're pursuing. Which is a bit like the fall of Rome or something, where these people have just got so drunk on money and power they've completely lost their minds.
It's about the size of it, Tony, about the size of it. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll wrap up this section with an analysis of the talks in Saudi Arabia, where China is said to be in support of a third round in a bid to find a framework for peace in Ukraine. Right back after this short break.
Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
This is Basil Valentine in for Patrick Henningsen today, Monday, the 7th of August, 2023. I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Tony Gosling, who was at the No to NATO, No to War rally yesterday in Whitehall, alongside our very own Patrick Henningsen and many others. And just to bring us right up to date, the last 2 days have seen a summit in Jeddah, the second of its kind after a similar forum in Copenhagen earlier this summer, which aims to draft key proposals on how to end the Russia-Ukraine war. China is said to be in support of a third round of talks to find a framework for peace in Ukraine after meeting senior officials from about 40 countries. Meanwhile, Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has said he hopes the initiative would lead to a peace summit of world leaders this autumn to endorse the principles based on his own 10-point formula for a settlement. These talks exclude Russia, but were attended by the U.S., India, the European Union, and China's special envoy for Eurasian affairs, Li Hui. What do you think, Tony? Is there any chance of the 10-point plan from Zelensky getting anywhere? Or is he living in cloud cuckoo land?
Well, I think, yeah, we do know that Zelensky does live in cloud cuckoo land. That's where he hangs out. And also, of course, that he doesn't really make any decisions for himself. He is really just an actor. I think there was a... was Scott Ritter's recent thing called Agent Zelensky, where someone pointed out that it's like boarding an aircraft and shaking hands with the pilot who stood there, who's dressed like a pilot. He talks like a pilot. He uses pilot jargon, you know, like talks about altitude and things like this. But he's not a pilot. He doesn't know what he's doing as an aircraft. And your life is about to be in his hands, which I think is a great way of describing what Zelensky is. In other words, he's not actually a politician. He's a public relations consultant for the Pentagon and for NATO. And so he's just given a script. He's told to say things. And this kind of synthetic world where we're expected to, well, actually the mainstream press really does kind of just go along with it. and we're expected not to see through it. We're expected, you know, to look at this kind of two-dimensional black and white cutout and make out that it's, you know, four-dimensional, three-dimensional reality. And it isn't. It's a real insult to expect people to buy into any of it. So the idea that he is actually putting anything forward is a joke. It's not him. And the other thing is, of course, that there are all sorts of things going on in Ukraine to do with trying and testing out all sorts of technology, new weapons technology, such as this Palantir software, Alex Karp's Bilderberg, Alex Karp's little company, which is being used to target and direct attacks on Russians. So the idea is, you know, you just flick the switch and your bit of software will say, we've got a bit of satellite intelligence here, we've got a bit of someone has reported spotting a Russian unit from a drone. You know, there's all sorts of inputs as to whereabouts the Russians might be. And the software then just sorts out, well, this one here looks vulnerable. We've got a good missile, which is good at busting these particular vehicles or whatever. And there's no human involvement in that at all. So that's what Palantir is doing over there. And that was all revealed around about Christmas time in 2022 in the Times, in an article which was a few days later taken off their website. But you can still find the article out there. It's quite obvious and clear, anyone that really bothers to look, that this is great for the West, for NATO. What they're doing is they're using Ukraine as a bit like the way that the British Army used Northern Ireland during the Troubles, which is just as a proving ground, a testing ground, and a way to just develop techniques for fighting these sorts of, you know, a kind of major European war. They're also able to see what the capabilities of the Russian equipment is. Now, I'm quite certain the Russians know that they're trying to do this, and so they have technology that they're holding back, maybe even at the expense of Russian soldiers, Russian troops of various sorts that, you know, that there is, the Russians do have technology that they could easily be using. And they also have intelligence of things that are going on behind lines with them, particularly with, you know, the NATO support. I don't know if you saw that thing recently, you know, there was a blowing up of a pizza restaurant, and we were told that it was just civilians, but actually the footage showed military people, and the World Service announced, the Radio 4 bulletin at 6 o'clock that evening announced that there had been several British people killed in the war zone. Now, what were they doing there? Well, of course, they're there covertly, and they are there to help the Ukrainians and also, of course, to trial all this kit out. So I don't honestly think that the West really wants to stop this. In the meantime, of course, they're enslaving Europe through this war. Loads of the European military equipment is going to Ukraine, and the European countries are then having to buy replacements, usually from the United States now. And so this really suits the Americans to keep this going. It's, you know, there's no real threat to them so far away. I don't think that there's really any kind of willingness or wish to end this at all. So maybe things in Saudi Arabia will come to nothing. That's what I think anyway, Basil.
Yes, having said that, I think that the people certainly of Germany have had enough. They were out demonstrating in Brazil and in other places. A new poll in the United States shows a majority do not want Congress to grant any more funding for the war in the Ukraine. And here in this country, I think people are increasingly aware that this is a very dangerous as well as an expensive scenario. So once again, the only people that seem to be profiting are the arms manufacturers. And meanwhile, and almost an entire generation of Ukrainians have been fed into the meat grinder by Zelensky. Now, you know, estimates vary wildly, but I've seen the figure of 300,000 Ukrainians and casualties quoted. Coincidentally, that's a figure not unadjacent to the number of casualties supposedly suffered by the French in their misadventure to Moscow in 1805 with Napoleon. It's an enormous number of casualties. We're used to a few thousand, as was the case in Iraq, for example. You know, I think sort of to about 10,000 US casualties. Many more, of course, committed suicide when they returned to the United States. But, you know, casualties running into the hundreds of thousands on something we've seen since the end of the Second World War, Tony.
Well, the casualty figures, I think you have to be a bit careful with, because both sides are spinning this. Certainly, there's far, far more casualties on the Ukrainian side, than there are on the Russian side. But still, obviously, you know, it's a very dangerous political thing for Putin to be doing this, because of the blowback. And, you know, domestically, there is a lot of criticism in Russia of it, because particularly because families are losing their, you know, young ones in this, young men being killed. But the thing is, what he's done is he's sort of pre-prepared the Russian people for this by the, you know, what was going on before the Russians went in last year in 2022. Is for many years there were all sorts of calls in Russia for the Russian army to go into the Donbass to protect the people in that southeast of Ukraine. And all the time Putin was saying, no, we need to try everything first. And so because he's pre-prepared the Russian people for this by making sure he didn't go in all guns blazing after the Minsk agreement started to fall apart, is he's now got actually a lot of political support for the people know that he's held off from this as long as he possibly could. And when we had Zelensky calling for nuclear weapons for Ukraine at the Munich Security Conference in February, you know, just a couple of weeks before the Russian invasion, you know, this is kind of the final straw, really. And I think most Russians support what Putin's doing. I mean, certainly more Russians support the Russian leadership, the president, the government, than do in anywhere in Europe, I think. You know, you look around Europe. Where is there a really popular leader or president? There isn't. And then now we've got this horrendous situation here in Britain where Tony Blair is absolutely, you know, the Tony Blair Foundation is behind Starmer. It's the policy machine behind Keir Starmer. And now, hang on, who is this Blair guy? Well, hang on, we all know he's a war criminal. He should have been in jail. But we also know that he's a totally failed politician. You know, this is the sort of thing that they've been doing in the EU for years. We're now doing it in the British Parliament, which is taking failed politicians and giving them new, very important roles. You know, in the EU, it's as commissioners. Here, it's as the policy chief for Keir Starmer behind the scenes. I mean, his energy policy has been drawn up by the Tony Blair Foundation. And whereabouts does the money come from that? Well, of course, it's from these tax-free foundations and the same sort of system as they use in the United States for funding these policy think tanks, which is, you know, the Rockefellers really did this in the 1960s and 70s, which they developed whole stables of academics, for example, to take over, say, for example, the history profession. You know, at universities where, you know, you got all these chairs started to be funded by at universities being funded by the Rockefellers. And so what we've had is that really our entire policy privatized bit by bit privatized. And, you know, what I'd like to see is a mixed economy where things like the gas, the water, etc., run by the government and by our parliamentary representatives and run at cost. You know, this is what we need. Infrastructure that I'm actually in Kent at the moment. I was driving along past a place near where I was brought up, and I've seen the river is now completely dry. We've had a lot of rain over the last few weeks or so in July, but no water in this river at all. And that's because Thames Water and all those other people are taking the water from the aquifers because it's cheaper than filtering it. They're taking it out of the ground, and our rivers are going down. We had the Thames dry up last year because of all this ridiculous privatisation. So let's just go back to a simple mixed economy where transport and things like that are run for public benefit by the government. And then also, of course, it gives us some point in voting. At the moment, there's absolutely no point. There's going to be no difference in this general election in 24, and probably it will be a very low turnout election between voting for the Tory and Labour. As Crispin Flintoff from Not the Andrew Marr Show was telling me last week, he thinks... He's one of the biggest campaigning fundraisers for the Labour Party under Corbyn. He thinks that it's going to be far worse if people vote for Corbyn than if the Tories get back in.
If people vote for Starmer, you mean, Tony?
Sorry, yes, Starmer. Sorry, I said Corbyn, didn't I? I still a remnant of me thinks as Corbyn, Labour Party, as having some. But it's that whole thing has been... And the reason he said that is because The Labour Party now has become so mafia-like, and there's absolutely no freedom of speech. You have to toe the line. There is no wriggle room at all, and that's why.
Tony, we're coming up to the break. We're coming up to the break. Do you want to stay for the first section after the news?
I'm going to have to bow out now. But if people want to catch up, okay, it's thisweek.org.uk every week on Friday at 5 o'clock.
We're going hard into the news. I can't thank you enough, Tony, and I agree with you. We should write the book on the great privatisation swindle.
Yes. Well, I did an article for RT about that, which is the Thatcher timeline of privatisation, which is quite well. If you can seek it out, it's. I still go back to it for reference. I can't find anything better.
Thank you, Tony Gosling. I'll talk to you very soon,
Basil. Yeah. Thank you very much for asking me, Basil. God bless. Take care.
Pleasure. It's been great.